This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. Today, we're talking about current laws around rape and consent in Indiana and a push at the State House to create a legal definition of consent. We're joined now by Republican House Representative Sharon Nagle, state legislator for District 13. Representative Nagle, what are current laws around rape and consent in Indiana?
So what current law is easily defined when a person is compelled by force or imminent threat of force in regards to rape. And it also covers specific scenarios if somebody's incapacitated or doesn't have the ability because of the mentally deficient to be able to consent to intercourse. Specifically what it's lacking and that other states have also recognized is consent. It does not clearly state what consent means. It is maybe implied, or as some would say, that it's not needed because we have case law that supports what consent would mean. And then also what it's lacking is when someone plays intentionally induces concealment of their identity. And we know of some scenarios where that's occurred, specifically occurs in more communal type settings, but rare as it is, it still is rape and it's not defined within our statute.
And can you explain that a little bit? Someone concealing their identity, how does that fit in?
So we actually had a situation at Purdue where a young woman was in her consenting partner's bed, and the partner had left the room, and an individual, knowing that the consenting partner had left the room, slipped in and was aware that the victim had no idea that that wasn't her boyfriend until farther into the act when she realized it wasn't him. And the individual was then confronted, and then eventually she filed a case against him. Prosecutors filed a case, but they weren't able to prosecute based on the way our current statute is that it just didn't cover exactly what had happened in her scenario. So this, again, has also been defined in other states' statute. So we're just trying to mirror kind of up to date what can happen and making sure it is covered within our Indiana statute.
It sounds like if something happens to somebody, they really have nothing to protect them at this moment. I mean, just I'm thinking about this case that you just mentioned. There were no repercussions for this person.
Right, because it's one, his identity was concealed. She truly thought it was her normal consenting partner. And, it was very, a very cruel act on that person, the perpetrator. And our current code just doesn't cover that circumstance. While it is a rare circumstance, we just felt strongly that it needs to be covered. And we're not the only state that has that kind of language in there. Obviously, I feel like, there are two areas in which our rape statute's lacking. One is, clearly stating what consent can be, and then clearly stating this example of concealment. The struggle is that there's always case law that, yes, supports these scenarios, but I believe it just isn't clear and concise to a jury who is always the trier of facts. So I think it's just really important that we clearly state it within our statute.
Can you talk about the bill you authored, House Bill 1079, and how it would add to the laws we have in place right now?
So 1079, which passed overwhelmingly out of the committee and then, of course, overwhelmingly out of the House, is now heading over to the Senate. And this bill, after considerable discussion on what the definition of consent should be, after going through a summer study, we worked really hard with the Indiana Association of Prosecutors, trying to come up with the concise language that we need to define. So in Section 5 of the statute, we provided a clear definition of consent. And then we also defined specifically the rare situation, narrowed it down to rape by fraud, when someone is deceiving themselves as the victim's normal consensual partner. So those are the basically two sentences we added to the statute, which to me then rounds out our entire rape code statute to really cover all the specific scenarios. And consent specifically is stated that the other person has expressed a lack of consent through words or conduct to sexual intercourse or other sexual conduct. I think it's clear that it's, you know, sometimes the physical differences between a man and a woman can be so significant that a physical fight isn't even possible. Someone can be pinned down and, or someone can be, you know, trying to pull their clothes back on. So, you know, that's a conduct. I mean, there are just those scenarios where force wasn't actually part of it. It was fear. So we just really have to make sure that we are very clear on how we describe this to the jury. And my concern is that right now it's inconsistent across the state from courtroom to courtroom and how this case law is presented by prosecutors or presented via the judge on direction. And the concern is that it's not as clear and concise. It's confusing to more confusing to the jury. We heard some examples, a summer study where a juror asked the judge, can you define consent? And the judge's response was, just use your own good judgment. And so that's the kind of inconsistency I want to eliminate. I want to make sure that it is in our state statute and clearly explains what consent is through words or conduct.
What prompted you to write this bill in the first place? I know there was essentially the same bill last year, something similar, but it didn't get past the Senate. So what prompted you to do this one?
So sometimes we know when trying to pass legislation, it does take a couple of sessions to actually get it through and get everybody on board on what the intentions are. Last session, this is identical language as last session. And again, you know, passed overwhelmingly out of the House again. And this time around, going to the Senate, we are really working hard on trying to get everyone on the same page of what the intent behind this language is. The Senate chair chose not to have a vote on it. The timing was a little stressful because it was the last bill of the last possible committee hearing, and we just kind of ran out of time. But I'm hoping this time around we will have a little bit more of a head start. And I have a team that I'm trying to develop around this bill and support that can work with the Senate and get the support that we need this time around.
Have you heard from folks who are opposed to this bill, or is it pretty resoundingly folks are supporting it?
So who's against it is the defense attorneys, and particularly they feel strongly about the utilization of case law. They feel that our current statute is sufficient and that the purpose of case law is to be able to address these particular issues. I, on the other hand, feel that that is not not sufficient, nor do the Indiana Association of Prosecutors feel that way. So it's not unusual that the Public Defenders Association versus the Prosecutors Association do not agree on some of these particular criminal code issues. But that's who would be against it, and that's who actually spoke in committee against it. And it's not unusual that if an attorney is on practices on the public defender side, tends to view this differently. So that's the typical opposition I deal with.
Is it a concern at all that survivors will not come forward if they feel like these laws are not strong enough?
And that's, of course, always presented in committee. And I'm hoping that this time around, we will have enough pressure and enough time to have plenty of testimony to reinforce that. And House, obviously, we don't have that difficulty. It seems to be on the Senate side. So this time around, we're hoping to jumpstart that.
Do you know of any neighboring states that have legal definitions of consent? Are you looking to any of them for this bill?
Well, the specific state that we actually modeled after was from Utah, another fairly conservative state. So it's, you know, each state is different, but that was the one that I really kind of looked at their language and working with the Indiana Association of Prosecutors, a specific attorney that's really involved with all the sex crime criminal code. It was quite helpful and helping me, you know, develop that language and figure out what would work best in our statute, because everyone's statutes are designed differently. It's not always comparing apples to apples.
Even with support and maybe this time around having more of a chance, do you think there's anything that could make it difficult for the bill to pass this year?
There is a tremendous amount of power when you're a chair of a committee, and a chair or committee can choose to pass or not pass a bill. So that is really the funnel we have to get through.
Well, we'll be back after a quick break. We're talking about efforts to create a legal definition of consent in Indiana. We're talking about current laws around rape and consent and a push at the State House to create a legal definition with Republican House Representative Sharon Nagel. We're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll continue the conversation. If you have any questions or comments, you can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter at All in Indiana, or you can leave us a voicemail at 866-476-3881. Again, that's 866-476-3881. I'm Miriam Soeb. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Soeb. We're speaking with Indiana Republican House Representative Sharon Nagel to learn about efforts to create a legal definition of consent in Indiana and how it could change the way cases of rape and sexual violence are handled. Representative Nagel, if a survivor of sexual violence goes to court in Indiana, what kind of challenges do they typically face?
So, you know, obviously the it's traumatic, and a survivor has to be able to withstand the entire process. That's probably partly why people don't even go forward, because of that whole humiliating environment you have to experience. But saying that, my concern really comes down to within the courtroom and how the case is handled. I feel that currently the way our current law works is just too murky. I feel confident that by adding this language, it really makes it easier for a juror to understand. I mean, case law is difficult to understand, you know, even amongst the most experienced that digest it. But we shouldn't expect jurors to be able to parse through that case law, rather than just giving them a real clear understanding of the law. And then, you know, all of these cases make it clear that sex without consent is illegal, then why not say it? Why not just put it right into our statute? And that, to me, is just the crux of our argument. You want to not put in the law because case law supports it, yet it just makes perfect sense. Why would you not put it into your code? So I just feel like the argument is just so strong in our favor to make sure that this language is inserted. And I really want to make sure that who benefits from this, of course, is the victim, because now the jury has a clear picture of exactly what our law states and what they should be looking at when it comes to that trial process.
But with regards to the current laws around sexual violence in Indiana, how old are they?
Oh, fair question to ask me. I would have to look at the date of when.
I mean, I guess not even specifically a date or anything, just, when's the last time anything's been changed around this?
I would say it's been a very, very long time. I just don't know that answer. So I know that we've been, over the last few years, been trying to address this. I'm not the first legislator trying to adjust this. So over my tenure, I know that there's been many bills that have been filed over the last 10 years and trying to address some of these deficits. I just finally jumped in and said, okay, let me take a crack at this and see if I can get something passed. My co-authors, one of them is Representative Arrington. She's been working tirelessly on this particular issue. And we really just worked together trying to figure out, okay, you know, this angle didn't work. Why not try this angle? And what we really honed in on is staying right within the rape statute instead of putting definitions in other areas of the code. That created a lot of pushback, even from the Association of Prosecutors. You just have to make sure that you're, you know, some of these issues are being affected only within the rape statute. So we get smarter about the approach, and we really feel like we've nailed it, that this is truly the best place to put the language. So it's a team effort. This is a bipartisan effort. This is not a Republican or Democrat specific issue. This is truly a protection of all victims of rape. And we really feel very strongly as women of this legislature that we have to get this passed, and we're determined.
What compels you to keep going? I mean, instead of just giving up and being like, okay, this didn't pass, let's move on to another type of bill.
I guess it's a dogged approach, and it's the victims knowing, you know, this is not an issue that's going to go away. I mean, this is a societal issue that we have to deal with. So I guess being a woman and being a mother, just listening to the stories and the pain that individuals have gone through, I just want to make sure that this is properly placed within our criminal code.
Are you doing anything differently this year compared to last year? I know we kind of touched upon it, but is there anything specific, any kind of approach that you're taking that you feel will work this time around?
Sure. So I'm really working hard on garnering additional support. I'm talking to judges. I'm talking to lawyers. I'm trying to really pull together a larger support team that will help me with the Senate side. In the past, I didn't work that as hard, and this time around, I have a meeting this afternoon actually with a judge. So those are the types of things that I think that can help. And I'm not a lawyer, but I really need some of the that legal strength behind me. And I've also the Senate sponsor that I chose is on that committee. And he actually had a personal experience of somebody within his family being raped. I just feel like, you know, we have to garner the support from a lot of different angles. And so that's been my focus this time around.
Is there any effort to try to get those defense attorneys on board that are opposing it?
Yes, I've had plenty of discussions, but I'm not sure if that will budge.
And do you have any sort of plans if this doesn't pass, what the next steps would be for you and the folks working on this effort?
Well, perseverance, it's you just can't ever discount perseverance. So if you can't get it this time, you try again.
Well, one thing that I've heard from other guests in the past is that sometimes it's harder for bills to pass the Senate than the House. Do you think bills like this are having more trouble at the Senate than they do at the House?
Well, yes, obviously it's this is the second time around. And I think that, you know, sometimes what happens is, you know, just over time, and you keep discussing the issue and you have other people coming forward saying, look, this is why this is a better idea. Eventually, you know, you turn the tide to get people to more comfortable. It's an uncomfortable subject matter. I mean, it's not something everybody wants to talk on a daily basis about. But the more you point out and the more that victims have the opportunity to speak to their senators, the additional support we should be able to garner. So hopefully the timing of this session is the key. And we pass it out of this House early. Again, I'm working hard on the garnering support outside of our legislative body to make that impact that we need to get it across the finish line.
What is it that you think makes it more difficult passing bills like this at the Senate? Aside from, I think you were mentioning earlier that maybe the timing, you know, it was just too close and they didn't have time to hear it. Is that really what's at stake at the Senate?
Well, I just think the Senate tends to be a different group of legislators versus the House. I think the House has we have 100 legislators, that is 50 legislators. I think the age difference is as obvious between the two bodies. It's just a different dynamic. Maybe more conservative over at the Senate side, but and maybe a little bit more apprehensive about change. So in some respects, that might be good. In this respect, I think that it needs to, you know, obviously change. So again, it really does come down to individuals and chairmanships, and it's a very powerful position. But hopefully this time around, we can garner that support that will put the right amount of pressure.
And can you tell us about the folks you're working on to help craft this bill? Who else is on board?
So the Indiana Prosecutors Association is a real strong supporter. I work specifically with an attorney that deals with sex crimes. She's an expert in this area. And Courtney Curtis is her name. And she's been a tremendous help in this legislation. That's what you need. You really need someone who is a legal expert in this area. So working closely with her over the last 2 years has been instrumental on developing the language and getting everything written properly. And then, of course, I'm always working with Victim Services. There's several organizations that I'm working with. And then, of course, just individuals that have gone through this. When we had the summer study, it was a really enlightening moment of the experiences of what various victims had gone through and heartbreaking. And so when you keep all of that within you, understanding what people have gone through and realizing that, you know, this, how much this law would have helped them, I can't give up.
With mention of the summer study, for our listeners who may not know what that is, can you give us a little insight?
Sure. So when Representative Arrington had filed a bill to affect the rape statute, it didn't get a hearing because there were a lot of issues with her bill that had to be changed. She didn't hit the mark on being able to get a hearing. So I promised to work with her, but we also together had asked. We had both submitted a letter to ask for it to be studied in the summer study. And we do that a lot, especially in criminal code. Whenever we want to change our code sites, we really would like to talk about it and research it, listen to some experts. And so every summer we have a summer study doing just that. And it's through requests of legislators. And that we had tremendous testimony. It really gave us some great insight. And that's when we could then sit down and work on writing a new bill to file. So that was, of course, my first crack at it. 1176 is when I filed it last session. And it was the result of that summer study and a lot of work behind it.
Is it unusual to have bipartisan support on bills like this?
No, not, you know, usually in criminal code, there is actually many times bipartisan support. Bottom line is nobody wants criminals out on the street. We want people to get into treatment. We want society to be safe. And so it's a balancing act, trying to figure out how to do that and also, you know, create a safer environment. So I think we've hit a lot of bipartisan tone within that committee.
What feedback have you gotten so far from groups who work on similar issues? Are they on board with House Bill 1079, or are there any additions they want to see or changes?
I'm not hearing of any changes. People are asking, and no one's asking me for any changes. I mean, the only opposition that I'm dealing with is the Public Defenders Association. And that's it.
Have you heard from any survivors about where they stand on this bill?
Every survivor I speak to is very supportive. I've not ran across any opposition to it. If anything, I've heard some survivors thinking maybe we should add more, but not less.
Right. And one thing I was wondering is when you have these survivors bringing up testimony, do they have to repeat their story every time there's a new iteration of this bill? That's got to be pretty tough.
It is. It is. And we really try to keep it. Sometimes I'll talk to those who are going to testify to try to keep it to a reasonable amount. What you don't want to do is overwhelm a committee with, a horrific story after horrific story. So ideally, you just try not to have the victim go through the traumatic experience other than, how would this bill affect them and other women in the future that could be raped, and that's what we try to keep focusing on.
Do you know if there are any other bills in the State House that are trying to tackle issues around how sexual violence is handled in Indiana right now?
Well, this is the main one. There's always some nuances within other bills that could affect crime. But this is the main one. And we have human trafficking, different bills like that definitely work their way into, crimes, sex crimes. But human trafficking is, another big issue we're dealing with in the state of Indiana.
What would your hope be? Let's say this bill goes through the Senate, it passes. What would the next steps be for it?
Well, if it gets voted out of committee and then heads to the floor in the Senate and then gets voted on, and if it comes out in the manner which I would accept, then I would choose to concur after my caucus would agree that it's good to concur, and then of course the bill would eventually head to the governor for signature. That's the goal.
Okay.
Once it gets signed by the governor, it goes into law.
And it would just be effective immediately. And how would that apply? I mean, I guess what I'm wondering is, so the things that are in that bill, would they just go
July 1, July 1 of 2022, and that is pretty standard. That's when all of our bills pass. That's typically July 1 of 2022. It's the beginning of a fiscal year. It's just the standard protocol for our bills. There are, in some cases, bills will have an emergency clause that's effective immediately. But those are real specific kinds of bills. This is pretty standard in how it works.
And what about, what are you looking forward to in the future with bills like this? What is your hope to see moving forward?
My hope it really is a bigger picture of making sure that we educate our population on healthy sexual activity and understanding, at a maybe younger age of what consent means. I feel like sometimes we get into this society of just kind of glossing over the subject matter. And being a mother of raising both a boy and a girl, and growing up and having those tough discussions, I just hope that this is enlightening and that more and more parents are willing to have that conversation with their children.
Yeah, these are definitely tough conversations that need to be had. And we appreciate everything that you're doing. And thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you.
Sharon Nagle is the Indiana Republican House Representative for District 13. We'll be back after a quick break when we go into a new conversation about changes to voting machines in Indiana and the issue of voting access. I'm Miriam Sobe. We'll be back in 90 seconds. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Miriam Sobe. In a committee meeting last week, Indiana lawmakers dropped changes to a bill that would require all electronic voting machines to have a paper backup by 2024. To learn more about this, we're joined by Brandon Smith, State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Hey there, Brandon. How's it going?
Good. Thanks so much for having me on.
You reported on changes lawmakers made to a bill about voting machines and voting by mail. What did the original language of the bill look like?
Yeah, this bill's been through a little bit of a roller coaster just in the first half of session. So the bill, as it was originally written, was fairly straightforward. So in 2019, Indiana lawmakers passed a law that said every county that uses direct record electronic voting machines, it's a specific type of voting machine, but basically it's if you go up to cast your ballot, it's on a screen. There's no paper like ballot that you punch out holes in or fill in a circle or anything like that. It's entirely done electronically. On any of those electronic voting machines, counties had to add what's called a voter verifiable paper audit trail, a VVPAT, as they're sometimes referred to. And so what these do is it's just a paper backup system for that electronic voting machine. A lot of times, generally speaking, what you'll see in a county that has one of these paper backup systems is when you are casting your ballot, when you're voting, making your votes on that screen, it's also going to, before you finish everything out and say, this is it, this is, I'm casting my ballot, this I'm done, it's going to show you on a piece of paper in this machine that you can't touch, but you can see, it's going to show you exactly who you voted for so that if there is a mistake, you can go back before that's officially been cast and correct it. It also, in addition to providing that sort of paper visual for the voter, it also is important for election security because, of course, if there's a problem with an electronic voting machine, there's really no good way to go back and say, were these votes cast exactly what they were supposed to be? Whereas if you have this paper backup, that's literally a roll of paper that has every ballot that someone cast, you can easily audit those elections, which is why it's called the voter verifiable, because the voter can see it, paper audit trail. So it allows you to, after the election is over, go back and say, okay, does this line up with what the electronic voting machine told us? So in 2019, lawmakers passed a law that said by 2030, every county that has one of these voting machines has to have this voter verifiable paper audit trail. The problem, and they did give them some money in the 2019 session to start to make that transition. The problem is that obviously election security has been a big issue for a long time, but particularly we've seen it crop up over the last couple of years. And election security experts generally agree that one of the most important election security measures you can have for these electronic voting machines is this paper backup. And so a lot of people were wondering, well, why are you giving them a decade to do it? So this bill this year would have moved that date up significantly. Instead of by 2030, it now said counties that have these voting machines have to have the paper backup system by July 1st of 2024.
And so what are the changes that lawmakers are hoping for with this bill? Or maybe they're not hoping for, it's just folks are pushing for that.
Yeah, it depends on which lawmakers you're talking about as to what they want. So again, I said this bill went through a little bit of a roller coaster. So it passed the elections committee unanimously. Everybody agreed, you know, Republicans and Democrats said, no, this is a good thing. We want these paper backup systems. Let's make counties get them. But there's an acknowledgement here from even the author of the bill, Representative Tim Wesko, that, well, this costs money, obviously, and counties aren't exactly rolling in cash. At a time when the state is flush with cash, counties live on much tighter budgets, especially when we're talking about election divisions and counties. So what he said in that initial committee hearing was he's been assured that the state will put up the money, which was about $12 million for everybody in the state who needs it. Not individually, like that was the total bill, $12 million. The state, it should be noted, has about a $4 billion surplus right now, and that's expected to grow to $5 or $6 or even $7 billion later this year. So it now goes to the Ways and Means Committee, which is the money committee for the Indiana House, because it has that fiscal cost attached to it. And what the Ways and Means Committee did was they just took out that section of the bill. They said, no, we're not going to move it up to July 1st, 2024. It costs money. We don't feel like paying it. We're not going to do it. And so it was back to 2030. And at the same time, they put in the language from another bill that imposed a new restriction on absentee mail-in voting, which is a separate topic, but they just put that into this bill. And so it took a bill that had unanimous bipartisan support into a harshly partisan measure. Now, there was one more wrinkle sort of to come with this bill, which is there was a lot of frustration and outrage, quite frankly, from people about not moving up that date for when these paper backup systems had to be in place. And so on the House floor, in the amendment process, Republicans added back in that July 1st, 2024 date. So as the bill currently stands, counties would have to add these paper backup systems by July 1st, 2024. And there's also this new restriction on absentee mail-in voting. But it's important to note that when they added the date back in and moved that up, they didn't put any money in there. So we'll see if they do that when they write a new budget next year. But right now, counties are going to have to do this somehow finding the money on their own.
When it comes to these, to the voting machines, electronic voting machines, is there any backup technology in them currently, or is that why they're pushing for this paper backup system?
I mean, the backups, any backups that are in there right now are sort of as part of the electronic system. So again, if there's a failure of that, you could be in some trouble, which is why so many people think these paper backups are so important. In addition to it's not just, the particular type of paper backup system we're talking about is not just, obviously it's important for going back after the election for election officials to be able to compare, okay, what do the paper rolls say? What did the electronics say? But it's also, again, a way for the voter to be able to see it before they say, confirm, this is the ballot I want cast. It's a way for them to look all in one place and say, okay, did I vote for that person and that person and that person? Yes, I did. Okay, we're good to go.
I mean, maybe I'm trying to be a devil's advocate here, but I'm just thinking there are so many electronic things that we do, tests in schools, and there's no paper backup. You got to just go with what you put in there. So, I mean, is there anything that is being looked at in that sense where?
Yeah, I think there's an acknowledgement that, you know, making sure our elections are safe and secure takes precedent over a lot of things, quite frankly. But it's interesting, though, you know, and this has been pointed out. If you look at society broadly, so much of everything we do is moving to digital, electronic, that sort of thing, as you just pointed out, testing and financial transactions and a million different things. And elections were part of that. Like, there was a move over the last decade to move away from paper into electronic voting machines because, oh, well, that's the future. That's the next best thing. But interestingly, there's been sort of a pushback on that when it comes to elections themselves, because there's a level of confidence in the paper that people don't necessarily have with electronic voting machines. Now, there's no evidence to suggest that there's ever been an issue with electronic voting machines in this state. They aren't ever connected to the internet. That's important to note. A lot of people worry about, oh, will the machines get hacked? And certainly there are foreign countries who are trying to interfere with elections via the systems that are on the internet, which generally are like the voter registration rules and things like that, which is why the state has taken numerous steps on cybersecurity over the last few years. But when it comes to the ballot itself, those machines are never hooked up to the internet, but there's still that confidence level of, okay, if I have a paper ballot, I know this is secure because it's in my hand, I'm filling it out. And so it is interesting to note that even as the rest of sort of society is continuing to move more and more into digitalization, there's sort of this push backwards on elections because we just have more confidence in that pen and paper.
Do you think lawmakers are going to see the changes that they're looking for with this?
I mean, it's in law. I mean, counties will do what they can, but again, I think a lot will be determined. Well, if this bill passes, which let's assume that it will, if this bill passes by the end of the session, a lot in terms of will these changes actually take effect will be dependent on next year when lawmakers write a new budget. We heard yesterday the House Speaker Todd Houston, when he was speaking in favor of the bill, saying, you know, we will pony up the cash, basically, that you know, you can rely on us to make sure that the money is there. So we'll see if that happens next year.
Another part of this bill, as you mentioned, would change restrictions for voting absentee by mail. What changes does this bill propose?
So there are about a dozen reasons right now that you are allowed to vote by mail in an election. A number of different things. If you're at least 65 years old, if you have a disability, if you're working the polls. But a big one that captures a lot of people is if you don't think you're going to be available on election day to cast a ballot. That's a fairly straightforward concept. You know, you generally will know where you're going to be on a single day. You know, if you're working or if you're out of town or whatever it is. What this bill now does is it says, well, it's not just are you going to be unavailable on election day, but it also says in order to cast a mail-in ballot, you have to be unavailable to vote in person in the 28 days before the election, when in-person voting is possible in Indiana. That has a lot of people sort of saying, well, if you're going, I mean, 28 days is a really long time. And by the way, you know, election day, it's very straightforward. The polls are open from 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. in every county in Indiana. There are polling places, you know, in multiple places in every county in Indiana. There's that sort of, you know, that's going to happen. But when it comes to early in-person voting in Indiana, it varies widely by county. You know, Speaker Todd Houston, again, yesterday on the House floor, speaking in favor of the bill, said, was talking about his county, which is Hamilton County, which is a relatively affluent northern suburban county of Indianapolis, talking about the multiple locations in his county for early in-person voting, the multiple hours of the day and the days of the week that it's available. And that's great. And a lot of counties are like that. But there are some that do not have those sort of opportunities. For instance, Marion County doesn't make it available nearly as many days, as well as there are very few locations. In fact, for most of that 28 days, there is only one place in the entirety of Marion County, the largest in the state, where you can vote, which is downtown at the city county building. And the reason there are so few locations throughout that month is because Republicans in Marion County refuse to allow more because it has to be done on a unanimous basis on the county election board. So it's great if you have lots of early in-person voting opportunities, but if you don't, which again varies by county, well, as Democrats pointed up who are opposed to this bill, they said, so you're asking someone to attest under penalty of perjury that they aren't going to be available for this 28 days, but they won't necessarily know what days they are available. They won't necessarily know where it's going to be available. And then, you know, how do I arrange my work schedule, childcare, transportation, all these other things? And what Democrats argue is, well, people won't take the risk. They just won't vote.
Mm-hmm. Are there folks who are supporting this bill that weren't previously in favor of this type of a thing?
I mean, it's very party line. So Republicans like this change, Democrats don't. And Republicans say that it's about, I mean, Republicans have it's a very clear policy position, which is they believe in-person voting should be the preference. And even, you know, more than I suppose preference, they are really pushing to make that as much as possible the option that people exercise when it comes to casting a ballot. Democrats have pointed out, and others have pointed out that, you know, Indiana's been doing mail-in voting for a long time. Last year, notably, because of COVID-19, for last year's primary election, they opened up mail-in voting to any Hoosier who wanted to do it. And we saw hundreds of thousands of people decide to exercise their vote that way. And there was no, you know, it wasn't a fraudulent election. We didn't have massive voting, you know, laws being broken or scams being perpetrated. That it just didn't happen. And there are other states in this country who use almost exclusively mail-in voting. Generally speaking, those are Western states. And again, those elections aren't fraudulent. Those elections go just fine. There is zero evidence, like zero evidence in the history of this country of widespread voting fraud, and especially widespread voting fraud with mail-in voting. You can find isolated incidents, of course, where there was somebody who was trying to scam the system with mail-in ballots. But one, those were caught, and two, they are isolated incidents. I mean, the rate of voter fraud in this country is like 0.00006% of ballots cast over the last 20 years. So the straight up argument is from Republicans, we don't want to encourage mail-in voting. We want to encourage in-person voting. But Democrats argue, well, you're just making it harder for people to vote for no reason. And I don't know how you can argue with that point.
Yeah, I mean, I'm thinking just with COVID and everything, if that would have changed folks' perception, and especially since this is an ongoing pandemic, that it might be here to stay.
Well, I mean, clearly it didn't change Republicans' minds. I mean, you there's also the political aspect of this playing out, in which former President Trump cast a lot of doubt about, and Republicans cast a lot of doubt about the safety and security of mail-in voting, baselessly. Again, as I just said, there's no evidence that it's an issue. And so you have that sort of political in the background. But also, I mean, yes, to your point, you can understand why people might be hesitant about standing in the long line of people right now amid the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. But quite frankly, Republicans don't think it's an ongoing pandemic, at least in the legislature. They are not acting like there is still something to be concerned about.
Well, I want to thank you, Brandon. Real quick, 10 seconds. Do you have any speculations about the outcome of this bill?
I think it's going to pass. I don't see the Senate stopping it.
All right. Thank you so much. Brandon Smith is the State House reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Micah Yason. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Adam Gross is our engineer and composed our theme song. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it anywhere you get your podcasts. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All in Indiana. I'm Miriam Sobe. Thanks for listening. This is All In.